Today is the 25th of June, 2002, in the location of Koinonia Fireside. And this morning, our presenter's name is Gail Ramshaw. And today's session is Images in the Lectionary, Section 4, Water. And its number is RG2002-04. Let's listen in.
Gail Ramshaw. Some of you have, how many of you are brand new to these sessions? Okay, a couple of people. I care a lot about the readings that the churches stipulate. The fancy word is lectionary. The word is actually used two different ways. The list of readings for each Sunday and feast day is called a lectionary, and a book in which they are all printed out is also called a lectionary, just to confuse everybody. One of the most remarkable, some people say the most important ecumenical agreement of the last 50 years has been the move in the Western churches, Roman Catholic and Protestant, an amazing consensus towards the several forms of the three-year lectionary. And that's what we've been talking about. My interest in a book that's coming out in the fall from Fortress is of the images that are in the lectionary, so that we can think about those images and appropriate those images into our own lives. So we've talked here about mountain and journey and tree and last night light, and today water, all of those being quite appropriate to visiting here at Holden. Is there anybody from previous days who thought of a question, a sort of general question about the lectionary or about how it functions? Anybody think of anything along the way? Yeah.
Do the Orthodox have a lectionary?
Yes, they do, and it is totally other than the Western lectionary.
Is it 1 year, 3 years, or anything?
It's a 1 year.
1 year lectionary.
Yeah. And it's an example of, you know, we can't agree with Eastern Christians about Easter, you know, and how they understand how the readings function. And as you, I'm sure you all know, the length of the services, all that is really quite different. And I don't know if at like the World Council of Churches, there's a move yet of conversation between Eastern and Western churches on lectionary.
Do they have three readings typically on Sunday?
I don't know. I'm sorry to say, I do not know much about the Eastern lectionary. I know a lot about the Western lectionary.
It's all right.
It's okay. I'll work on that. I know that they do one thing. I've been to a Russian Orthodox Easter Vigil, which is really quite an event. People start coming into a really done as best as it can be done. And of course, in Eastern Orthodox churches, there's no seating. You stand for the whole event. And so people start crowding in around 7 p.m. on Saturday night. It actually, I think, started at 10 p.m. And I left at 3:30, and they were in the fourth language reading of the gospel. So they hadn't even got to the Eucharist yet. But I was glazed over by 3:30.
You
go outside and walk all over. And then they go immediately from the service, which ends then around dawn, to a great feast where they eat all the food that they fasted from during Lent. So I was sorry I couldn't stick it out. I'm not up on how they deal with the lectionary. You had a question?
Yeah. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada uses the continuous readings
in
ordinary time, and I was wondering
why
the arguments are for that.
Yeah. Why it happened, actually, is that there's few enough Lutherans in Canada that they felt that the more important ecumenical connection was with the other Protestants of Canada. And the other Protestants of Canada choose the semi-continuous readings. So it was, as often in liturgy, is that the real reason for something is a completely practical reason. often later on there gets to be some great, maybe even theological explanation of it. But that's part of the fun of liturgical history, is to say, how did, like, why did Christmas get set on the winter solstice? Well, it has nothing to do with Jesus, you know. It had to do with a cultural party already going on. So that is the primary reason. And I know that the Canadian Lutherans are kind of caught, because if they use the Augsburg material, the Augsburg material is going to wish that you used the parallel readings, not the semi-continuous readings. Were you here when I mentioned the articles that are coming out? Are you a Canadian Lutheran?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a journal in the States called Doxology. It's put out by some very liturgical Methodists, if you can believe that interesting thing. And in their fall edition, a theological library or something probably even gets it, but could certainly have these articles emailed up to you. There's going to be a pair of articles. One is going to argue why the semi-continuous set is better, and one is going to argue why the parallel set is better. I wrote the parallel set article, and I'm real excited to see whether this pairing of the two articles works out well, and it would be helpful.
Okay.
But anyway, it was largely just the reality of the Canadian situation.
Had you heard the argument that, and I was sitting and had mentioned to me that not a lot of people are reading scripture a lot anymore, and
no.
We don't know these words
yes.
of the, especially
yes.
the Hebrew Bible, and
right.
So that they're wanting to just have them read in church.
Yes, that is the primary reason for the Calvinist option now, is to acquaint people with the stories. I am, passionately concerned that people know the Bible, so I share the concern. I don't think that one of three readings on consecutive Sundays, then disrelated from the gospel, is a good way to do it. I mean, were you here when I talked about the cane ramp principle? You know, if you ramp your sidewalks so that they're good for wheelchairs, you will then have people using white canes walk out into the traffic. If you solve one problem, you will create another problem. And I always urge all of us simply to go into any problem solving with the humility to realize we'll cause another problem. I am so aware of the homiletical, Christological problems you are going to have if your primary reading is those Old Testament stories. So that I think those Old Testament stories should be taught. I see so many difficulties, because I think then the stories often become the focus of the sermon. And of course, then you're not using the lectionary as it was intended at all. The lectionary understands always the gospel as the primary reading. Because Sunday is the day of the resurrection. So the whole reason we're gathering together is to celebrate the resurrection. So you start using the lectionary for a purpose it wasn't intended. But people who are reading the Old Testament stories, great. I don't want to tell them not to do it, you know. But the learning the stories is the primary reason. One of the tricks about that on the first level is that the stories are often far too long to read. They're very complex stories. An Old Testament verse is give or take twice as long as a New Testament verse. So 10 Old Testament verses is already a reading twice as long as the New Testament. Often there has to be a lot of editing so that it's hard to read those stories actually out of the Bible, because the stories may have interloping, you know, so there gets to be very interesting problems. I was part of the conversation, which was a rich and wonderful conversation about whether the Texts of Terror should be in the three-year lectionary. The Texts of Terror, for those of you who don't know that language, is language used to describe particularly three stories of the mutilation of women that are in the Hebrew Scriptures. The rape of Tamar, the death of Jephthah's daughter. Help me.
The what, story in Judges 19?
Yeah, all right, the cutting apart of the mistress. And it was a fascinating discussion about how do we choose what to read on Sunday morning, you know? What do you do with these stories? One of the horrors of those stories is that God doesn't intervene, you know? Jephthah is never condemned for having killed his daughter. He's listed in Hebrews as one of the great, great signs of faith, you know? So it's a time, it's one of the times that we stand in a kind of horror before the scriptures. Well, how is that going to work on Sunday morning? You know, is it going to work well? Is it not going to work well? It would be related, it's a more extreme example, like, you know, the Rape of Tamar, to some of the material from the pastorals. You know, women, they're just gossips. Make them stay at home and shut up and, you know, no jewelry and no hair braiding. And, well, that's in the Bible, you know. Should we be appointing that on Sunday morning?
Well, we remember the innocents.
Yes, but the thing is, then there's this tradition, that would be an example of where there has come to be a tradition of how to tell a horrible story and bring it in. And the horrible story ends up being to praise them as martyrs, if you like that or not, that's how it's been used. And so you're right to examine, see that as an example, that there's a continuum of all these, you know, stories we like, stories we don't like. I mean, last Sunday, two Sundays ago, Jesus tells the disciples not to go to the Samaritan villages, you know, but only to the Israelites. So there are little things that we go, oh.
And then there are, I don't know any pastor that says, oh good, I get to preach on this, burn the innocents this week.
Well, I've heard a couple good ones because it comes right after Christmas, of course. And it's almost like when we all got up here to Holden, we were delighted to see our daughters, and the gospel was how daughters are going to be against their mothers and mothers against their daughters. You know, like, did we need that this week? All right? So right after an American Christmas, to have Slaughter of the Innocents is a... But, you know, and that it's a very good example of the questions about how you choose what... how does the Christian church stand before the Bible? How do we hear this? How do we say that was the word of life, that was God speaking? And so lectionary decisions, I think, I don't know of any perfect lectionary. You know, we keep working away at it. But the three-year lectionary has proposed to the Christian church something that it has never had, and that is approximately 200 sets of gospel readings paired with Old Testament readings, and half of them paired with epistle readings. That's really a Bible juggling act that is an interesting gift or whatever, you know, to the Christian church. There was something in the Middle Ages that has intrigued me. You know, sometimes Lutherans say, nobody knew about the Bible until Luther came along. Not true, all right? Not true. And those of you who are Swedes or Norwegians and you go to the motherland, all right, for your vacation at retirement, all right, be sure to visit the churches. You know, we'll get you a map of them that were fully painted in usually the 14th, sometimes the 15th century, so we're talking before the Reformation. And because, you know, whitewashing Calvinists never got up in that cold climate, they were not covered up during the Reformation. Many of the painted churches in Europe were covered up with whitewash, and now there are art restorers that are taking the whitewash off all those churches to see what the wall paintings were. When you go home, you are required by me to rent the film Month in the Country, which is a film about a shell shock victim of World War I being employed in a little Yorkshire town, taking the whitewash off a church to expose the medieval wall paintings. Well, that's going on all over Europe. In Sweden and Norway and Finland, they didn't cover them up. So you can just go and see them, 600, 700 years old. And what is the dominant pattern is of a picture of Christ flanked by two Old Testament pictures that are somehow paired with them. And there's a whole scheme of those. The scheme is published in books, it was put on walls, it was embroidered into paraments. We don't know who made up the scheme, but we see it all over Europe, and it's in a whole bunch of Swedish churches. So if the people were not blind, they were sitting in churches that from the floor, or sometimes maybe shoulder length, the entire building is biblical wall paintings. All right? And then often on the pillars of the church are the saints. And sometimes the saints are like this, they're holding up the ceiling. So there's really clever things that are done. And, you know, the art depends on how good the local artist was. But that there was a pattern that was sent out all over Europe. We see it all over. So the idea that to think about Christ carrying the cross, of course you'd also think about the story of the sacrifice of Isaac. That would be right there, right next to your pew or your bench in the church. That would be painted on the wall. And then all these stories of the life of Christ put parallel to other stories. So the idea in the lectionary of making parallels between the Old and New Testament is not new, even though the elaborateness of the three-year lectionary is quite new. Where does this come from? Remember, Paul says Christ was raised according to the scriptures. Well, the New Testament wasn't written yet. The scriptures he's talking about is the Hebrew scriptures. Christ is raised, as you know, from reading the Hebrew scriptures. Luke, with the disciples of Emmaus, begins with the whole Hebrew scriptures and tells them the story of the Messiah. All right. So I was going to get today to the Easter Vigil. The Easter Vigil's seven, or how many does your parish bear? Four? Seven? Do you do all 12? This is not a Reader's Digest version of the Bible. These are all the resurrection stories. All right? These are the stories about how God brings life out of death, just like the story of the resurrection is the story of life God bringing life out of death. So that's some of the history of the Christian tying together. The New Testament as we know it isn't really thought about as a unit until about the year 150. Even Augustine in the year 400 would never have seen a thing together, a scroll, the New Testament. You had all these books. And in about the year 150, there was this great debate. Which books will be, and what decided, what the question was is, what books should Christians read from on Sunday morning? That's the question that went into the decision about what becomes what we call the New Testament. So I say, what they were doing, of course, was constructing the lectionary. You know, these are the books that you can read from on Sunday morning. Don't read from those books on Sunday morning. And of course, if you go to, you know, your local Borders, you can buy now, it's very easy to get, all the other Gospels, what are called the non-canonical Gospels. The Gospel according to Peter, Gospel according to St. Mary Magdalene, the Gospel according to Mary, Gospel according to Thomas. There are plenty of other Gospels. Scads of other readings, other stories of the Acts of the Apostles. Acts of Thecla is a very interesting one to read. She was a companion of Paul who sort of cut her hair and tried to lived the freedom of a male in that society and preached and did miracles. Well, she didn't make it into the canonical New Testament, but you can certainly read about her. So the decision, which didn't occur then till about the year 150, which of these books can we read on Sunday morning and which shouldn't we read? And then those books get thought about as what later becomes, you know, our New Testament. But there certainly are, before that, when they're meeting on Sunday morning, Sunday evening for their meals, they're reading from the Hebrew Scriptures. Okay? There's so many things that fascinate me we don't know. Who ran around and got copies of all Paul's letters? I mean, we don't, you know, there's so much we don't know about the history. Who wrote these things? Scholarship now is pretty agreed that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, none of them were written by associates of Jesus. They're all written later. You know, you get this if you read very carefully Luke 1:1. Let me read this to you. Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed us onto us by those who were from the beginning eyewitnesses. So we've got eyewitnesses. We've got the next group, a large group, many, who are writing down what the eyewitnesses said. I, too, decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, almost excellent Theophilus, because I'm such a good writer. And you know what? Luke is a good writer. And much of the Jesus people know is Luke's Jesus. It's wonderful stories in Luke. And great, all, you know, the Mary stories, that's all Luke. The Christmas story, that's Luke. Jesus forgiving people from the cross, that's Luke. Okay. But there you get a sense. I mean, Luke is not claiming to be an eyewitness. He's claiming to be a better researcher than the others who have gotten the information from the eyewitnesses. But it's, I don't know, anything about that, or should we get onto water? It's one of these topics that almost always the answer that the teacher can give is, well, we don't know. We don't know the answer to this. Well, why don't we get into the water by singing one verse of 583. In Christian language because of baptism. Let me just begin by saying that today is June 25th, which in the Lutheran calendar is the commemoration of the presentation of the Augsburg Confession. Yay, Luther, yay! Melanchthon. Melanchthon was a layman. All the lay people raised their hands. Yay, Melanchthon. And of course, one of the Lutheran Reformation's sort of rediscoveries again was baptism. That was baptism that was what it was all about, you know, not ordination, not monastic vows, not making pilgrimages to Rome and going up the sacred steps on your knees, but being baptized. So I'm sure that Luther and Melanchthon and all those are delighted that we're talking about water today. Someone mentioned before was in one of the sessions, Luther's talk about the daily creeping back to the font. That every day, you know, that's why he says, when you wake in the morning, you make the sign of the cross and say, most of us learned the translation, in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Actually, Tim Wengert's latest translation says, that's not really what the German says. It's under the care of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Is closer to what, and so that the latest Augsburg Fortress translation of the Luther Small Catechism has that newer casting of the morning prayer that you are baptized. So water. I'd like to do what I always do, is go back before the Bible. Where did the Bible get its images? Certainly, I was raised in a much more literalistic use of the scriptures. I remember the picture in my Bible study book in Lutheran parochial school that had this old man with a beard writing with his quill pen. And there was a dove up in the corner of the room, and then this ray came down. Who remembers that picture? This ray came down. So that it's almost like, you know, the way Yeats talks about automatic writing, you know, as though the words are so directly the word of God that they come almost without the mediation of the human being. I don't now think that that's how it came about. I think that God works through the mediation of human beings, it always does. The primary one being Jesus of Nazareth, but all of us being other human beings through whom God works. And that the scriptures came about also that way. And so where did the people who told the stories of the Israelites and their memory of faith and salvation, I don't think they didn't make up these things, and I don't think they came in a ray of light. I think that we use the stuff of the earth, we use the stuff of earlier civilizations and religions and stories and remake them. Well, this is the way we remember that the divine saves the human. So if that's the way you're going to go, you go back in the ancient Near East before the formation of the Israelite people, before the writing of the books of Moses. And there was a very important myth that was held in various versions, but I'll tell the famous of them. Various versions of the people of the ancient Near East. And this is the story. The story is that at the beginning of time, there's watery chaos. And the watery chaos is presided over by the great mother goddess monster herself named Tiamat. Mothers aren't always nice. Okay. So she is the great consuming mother, all right? And the sort of the god beyond the sky commissions a man whose name is Marduk to engage her in battle. And Marduk conquers Tiamat and rips her apart and makes the earth out of her carcass. And she's got a lover named Kingu, and the gods take the blood of Kingu and form human beings. And then Marduk sort of organizes the earth and builds the great city of Babylon and becomes the first king. And he is, of course, the king because he is the son of God. He sort of, the story ends up being that, well, Marduk was really the son of the deities and then comes to conquer Tiamat. Well, we could spend an hour on that, couldn't we? Any comments or questions about this? You could go to your library and access a readable translation of the text that actually has survived the thousands of years. It's called the Enuma Elish. But it is a great epic poem. And you can see evidences of it if you know about ancient art, if you know about Babylonian stories, Assyrian stories. That's a story that in various versions was very important in that part of the world. Now, what do we do with this story? Psychologists, of course, could say it's the great psychological truth that you have to get out of your mother in order to grow up. And if you do not conquer your mother, she will suffocate you. All right, are you all into that in your therapy? Okay, dealing with your mother. My life experience is that younger people, women especially, think that what they have to deal with is their father, and older people say, no, it's the mother that you're really dealing with. So psychologists say, well, this is an ancient myth about sort of human consciousness. Some sociologists say, well, it does appear that in many places in the world, the initial social system was mother-run, matrifocal. A mother had children. And they, she was in charge of the children. And maybe she was bonded with a man and maybe not. Some societies, yes. Some societies, no. It was a very egalitarian society, okay? Everybody about on the same level. And mothers, that's, by the way, much of what was in some of the Native American tribes here, so that when the Europeans came over, they couldn't figure it out at all. They just weren't prepared for mother-focused, egalitarian societies. But that something happened in the world about 3,000 years ago. All around the world, there came to be a number of advances technological. And it usually is a written alphabet, a rise out of a subsistence living. All right, so a more affluent a social system, transportation systems. Come on, what is the rest of them? More stratification of society. So I'm in charge of baking all the bread because I'm good at that, and you're really in charge of all the sewing. All right, so we get money and barter systems. That what happened with that set of or some of those things coming together is that patriarchal rule took over against the female rule. And what you see then is literature that says, no, not the mothers, we're not into that. Fathers rule. And fathers rule because they are the sons of the gods or goddesses. In Egypt, the ruler is a male, but he's the son of the goddess. Okay, it's very interesting. So there are great books now, like how did this all come about? All right, sort of what would then be called the rise of patriarchy, that males run the society in a hierarchical way rather than mothers sort of taking care of the 20 people around them. All right. Well, this story comes from that period of history. So do you see, some people could say, well, isn't this an interesting story? Too bad for Tiamat, her time is over. She's the monster in the water. She is sort of the womb, okay, the mess of the womb. The man who becomes the king has to conquer her and take over. So is it a psychological story? Is it a social story about, now we are into father rule, not mother, mother care, mother domination. So there's all kinds of studies and examinations of this Enuma Elish, this story. Greek myths also have similar stories. Of sort of you, Gaia, all right, is kind of put down and Zeus takes over, right? Okay, you can see that layer in lots of the ancient mythic stories. And people are wondering, all right, is this sort of chronicling a change in how the social structure is ordered? Any comments or questions about this? I know that we could just spend the whole, and I was all off on my clock yesterday, so I'm trying to be very careful about my clock. But I will tell you what biblical scholars have done with Enuma Elish. And that is they've said, wow, what do we have in Genesis 1? We have God who controls and orders the chaos of the water at the beginning. Right. According to some Christian readings of Genesis 1, there's nothing. But in some say, well, you know, the Hebrew is not totally clear. There is this watery chaos at the beginning. And then God brings order out of the watery chaos. Is this a different version of the that water is female and chaotic and birthy, and then you have to kind of organize it into human society, and maybe that's going to be modeled with a male way rather than a female way. Biblical scholars also say maybe this is in fact the kind of imaginal origin of the story of the Exodus. All right, biblical scholars are generally agreed now that as the story is presented in the book of Exodus, it is highly unlikely that it happened in any way quite like that. All right? This is a debate. You can all get into it. Jews are into it too. Their latest, the conservative Jews, we're not even talking Reform Jews, conservative Jews have just published English translation of the books of Moses. The Bible translation is entitled The Tree of Life, with extensive notes. And there's a great deal of controversy about this publication of the Bible because the extensive notes say things like, well, you know, in the way it's described, the Exodus didn't really happen. Now, how do Jews tell that story? So whether details are exaggerated, whether the whole thing is a story that comes sort of what the most liberal biblical scholars would say is, it's the Jewish version of the Tiamat story. You've got the chaos waters of the river, and you've got the man who, with the help of God, can tame the waters. We can go through the water and come out alive, anew, reborn. And of course, the Exodus story is repeated at the beginning of the book of Joshua, right? They do it again. All right, Joshua, they come to the Jordan River, and he has to have the waters part, all right? And he leads the people through. Remember in the 12 stones they carry across. It's repeated again with Elijah. All the biggies get to part the water, all right? When Elijah goes up to God, remember he takes his mantle, and he throws it on the water, and the water parts, and he can go through. So sort of, if God is with you, if you're going towards the things of God, then the waters will part before you, and you're able to walk through. So, you know, psychologists will go, well, yeah, this is all birth stuff, you know. You got to go through the water in order to come to the life of your own on the other side. And even, you know, for Christians who understand that to be a quite factual story, we've got the same sort of image elements in it. that water is there both to drown you and to save you. All right? This time it might get you, drown you. You might be the one who goes through. Another biblical sort of, you know, gloss on this whole story would be Noah's Ark. Okay? Noah's Ark is really a story of the destruction of the whole earth again. Okay? I mean, we've sort of made it into a cute children's story. It ain't no cute children's story. Okay? I mean, it's understanding the slaughter of nearly every human being and every animal. All right? It's hardly a cute story. So God reproduces the initial water cast. Remember it says in the Noah's Ark story that the windows of the heaven open so that all the water above the sky falls down, and the torrents come up out of the ground. So in other words, the boundaries that God put on the water, remember in Genesis 1, God puts the sky there with some water above the sky and some water below the sky. Why? That the water up there is going to be the rain. Okay? That's where the rain comes from. When God opens the windows of the sky and the water comes down. And then, of course, the next day what God does is put some of the water over here so that the land can show up. Okay? So that you can think about the early parts of the Genesis 1 story to be God's ordering of water. And in the creation story that's told in the book of Job, Job 38, remember after Job complains for about 30 chapters, I don't know where they got the idea of the patience of Job. This guy was not patient. God shows up and says, shut up. You don't know nothing. Where were you when I put the boundaries on the waters and said, this far you may go, ocean, but no farther? All right? So that poetic version of creation story that's in Job 38. Is another one that says what God does to bring order to the world is order the water first, okay? And then the water is tamed and can give life to people. By the way, this week, next summer, the gospel is Mark, Jesus taming the sea. Guess what the Old Testament reading is? Job 38. Where you hear this story of God saying, where were you when I tamed the waters? Well, we read that.
Tell the Canadian Lutherans to do it.
You read that when you then get to the Mark story where Jesus tames the water. Why can Jesus tame the water? Because Jesus is God among us. So you're going to get that same business that you had in the creation story, you had in Job. The taming of the water. Anything about all that? Yeah.
I'm not sure about following, but are you saying that in any image of taming water and chaos, that it's also a taming of the feminine?
Well,
are you going that far?
I don't.
You're saying some people.
Well, how I would say it. Is to say, I think that the story may very well have functioned that way when it was written. A very good way to see that is in the Greek play The Eumenides by Aeschylus. Aeschylus writes a play which is exactly the same thing. The Furies, that are the old women who have run Athens, end up in a cave. And virgin women are supposed to bring them flowers once in a while. And who takes over is Zeus. It's an interesting story about kind of the idea that Athens is now being run by men. All right, this is what it means to be in Athens. And you can get that at any borders, and it's very interesting to read. I think that's what Aeschylus was doing. All right, what do I, as a feminist Christian, do with that? I can say, that may have been the intent of the writer. I certainly would not hope that current interpretation of the story of Genesis would say the point is that men win out over women. Even by the end of Genesis 1, males and females are understood as equally in the image of God.
Right. I mean, yeah. It seems to me that gender isn't even in the text.
That's right.
Creates
no.
Male and female.
Yes.
Or you could say that you know, the brooding of the spirit is
a feminine one, right.
But we need some way to talk about the chaos of death, right? And water is such an elemental, a fundamental image for that. It works, but I don't think we have to tie it to
one of the things that I constantly...
I like the fact that it's so different from the Tiamat story, I guess. Is,
oh, yeah, that's right.
You know, that seems to be kind of the myth of redemptive violence, if you want to use... that
excellent.
Phrase or that language,
okay.
And where it's Genesis is creating order out of chaos, but in a way that's life-giving. It's, you know, through the word, right? It's not through violence.
The Genesis stories, the several of them, of the creation of human beings, they're almost all of them better than other ones that you can find. Let me say that... This is a fascinating issue for contemporary Americans who want to, not offend other people and speak it right. You could end up, I would say, simply not being able to use anything from other societies. Other societies assumed hierarchy. They assumed a male dominance. That's just in all the great literature. You know, what do you do with that? We were just teasing Beth about, she was reading The Care of Sons, House on the Prairie, and sort of changing them. So, Pa made dinner that day. You know, I said, Beth, good luck. That's a kind of a joke way to say it's a huge question. What do we do with those texts? There are certainly there's some biblical use of women's stories that I find interesting and helpful, but not how I would do them on Sunday morning. To me, on Sunday morning, almost never is the sex of the person an issue that would function. I think they are images of the human being, the baptized person. So whether it's, you know, the woman of Samaria or the man born blind, it's still you and me. And then that's the task of the interpretation. How can we take this ancient story, even if its categories, the intent of the author was not our intent. How can we use that to speak mercy in the community? And then you get to a question like, as we were talking before, the text of terror. Will this one work? Or, you know, is this going to be so hard to use to bring mercy out of it? And it would seem to me that whether you're talking lectionary or just Bible study with Christians is a really ongoing question. Yeah.
So those theologians that would say that the Exodus didn't happen
right.
as we've been thinking.
Yeah.
So how do they think it happened? Several water experiences or does it symbolize a growth or enlightenment or?
Yeah, it's hard to, there would be so many different gradations of how to think about, you know, a book that might be helpful, it's in our bookstore here, Marcus Borg's Reading the Bible Again for the First Time, you know, taking the Bible seriously but not literally. Biblical scholars, there seems to be a growing consensus that that many of the stories before the time of the monarchy, David lived in 1000 BCE, so that's easy to remember, that the stories are written, many of them are not written down for even 500 years after that, but that the stories that are told are more or less historically accurate. And, you know, some people would say they're pretty accurate, and others would say, Egypt kept meticulous records through that entire period. There is no indication of Semitic slaves building the pyramid cities. Oh, in fact, I just heard this on NPR. Terry Gross was interviewing the Egyptian head of the Antiquities Department or something for the government. And he was saying, he was talking about one of the latest finds, which was the burial sites and the markers commemorating the people who built the pyramids. And she said, didn't the Jewish slaves build the pyramids? And he said, no, scholars, we know who built them, and they were these, you know, we know enough about how the Egyptian building went on. And she kept coming back to it, like she really didn't believe him, that the Hebrew slaves didn't build the pyramids. I think probably the safest answer is we mostly don't know. We don't have a clue about it. But if you would be a Christian who would say it never happened, you would say that that like many stories in the Bible, the biblical record is of the faith of our parents and grandparents. And so how the story is remembered has to do with passing down to each generation the tradition of faith in God. And so you tell that story. You know, I'm a devout watcher of Antiques Roadshow, and it's so interesting that often, I would say the majority of times that the person comes with a family story of the provenance of that thing, it's wrong. You know this, right? And they try to be nice to the little old lady. You know, no, it's not a Stradivarius violin. Okay, sorry. But it's actually poignant to see the way the item has family value because of a story, and whether in fact what the scholar says about the Stradivarius violin, how that's going to function.
Maybe the Hebrews saw all that in a different light. Exaggeration of how many. And
right.
So maybe there were a few slaves that built something.
Absolutely. I think biblical scholars would say now that the people who become ancient Israel, well, you know, this is a politically viable, you know, issue. There's one of the things that we were dealing with forming the Revised Common Lectionary, the passages in the Hebrew scripture that give the geographical boundaries of the promised land. Should those be in the lectionary? There's, you know, that's another, like, okay, here's an issue you may not have thought about. Did God give the Jews a piece of land? Well, that's the headlines of every newspaper today, you know?
You said kill all the inhabitants.
Yeah, no, that's right. So it's, you know, it's not only like ancient stories or the role of women. I mean, there are many different, is disease a sign of punishment from God? All right, huge part of the Psalms are assuming that. What do we do with that?
And also psychologizing the text so that Exodus becomes the symbol of a birth ritual rather than a liberation theology. That's a huge shift that really benefits the dominant culture by saying, well, what this is really about is just your personal birth ritual. And taking that away from, say, Latin America, that, no, the Exodus didn't really happen, and God is on the side of the oppressed.
No.
What, you know, this perspective is a huge shift that has ethical implications. No. It's not just liturgy.
Yeah. No, that's right. Some of the interpretations are far more accessible to communal interpretation than others. There's one little verse in the Exodus story that I always think of in this regard. So the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, so that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and their chariot drivers. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. Wrong verse. I got to go to the beginning. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night, and the waters were divided. I love that verse. Moses did it, God did it, the east wind did it. I love that verse. What did it? Well, Moses and God in the east wind. You know, right there, even you're saying, how do we want to account for our salvation? You know, is it patriarchal power? Is it divine intervention? Was it this natural phenomenon that the east wind came? Or at least a phenomenon of nature? So one tiny example where even the writers are giving you, well, option there about understanding how the salvation came. We got a problem. We got 5 minutes. And I was going to go through all the Easter Vigil readings.
Can you get to John 3?
Water from creation, Genesis 1. Noah, water, survival from death. Exodus, water delivering us from slavery. Isaiah 55, we drink the water, come all who thirst. Ezekiel 36, washing, all right? The major Ezekiel 36 image is the washing. And of course, Ezekiel 37 is the dry bones. There's no water in it because there's no water. That's why we're all dry bones. The current lectionary list includes Jonah 3, where Jonah goes in and preaches to the Ninevites. Actually, the ancient use of Jonah, this is a mistake in the lectionary, because the ancient use of Jonah at Easter is, of course, Jonah 1, that Jonah is in the belly of the fish for 3 days. Even Jesus said, right, I'm like Jonah. Remember Jonah, all right? I was in death for 3 days. So Jonah is in the sea for 3 days and then comes up. In these churches I was telling you about in Sweden, it's very common that the resurrection picture has Christ coming out of the tomb with his great cross turned into a standard, you know, like a victory pillar thing. And the picture next to him is Jonah coming out of the fish and grabbing onto a tree on dry land and pulling himself out of the mouth of the fish by hanging on to the tree. The tree. There's all that water. So that some expositors would say that all the Easter Vigil readings point to baptism. I say that they also are all stories of the resurrection. Okay? We are the ones in the ark. So we call our churches nave. What's the word nave? Navy. Boat. We're in the boat. All right? We are in Noah's ark. We're the ones being saved. We are the ones who've gotten through the water safely in baptism. We're the ones who come to drink from the living water. We're the ones who are washed, as Ezekiel 36 says. And that all those then become the access we have to life through Christ's resurrection. I was then, having finished that all very carefully, was going to do the water of Lent. Because as I said the other day, in the new lectionary, Lent is about our approach to the font. The Lenten readings are not about Jesus dying. The Lenten readings are about us coming once more each year with the newly baptized to the font at Easter. So in cycle A, you get the great John readings about baptism. The man born blind, no, Nicodemus, okay, remember about being born again, water, birth. The woman at the well, John 4, the water we drink. The man born blind, John 9, the water that washes our blindness away. And the raising of Lazarus, John 11. Where's the water? I said, well, Jesus is weeping. God is crying over the death that we must live through. Those four great chapters, I hope you read the whole, have fabulous readers, okay? Don't like cut those readings. That's what Lent is about, those great stories where people are brought to the water and get new life. And so we then go to Easter, to the Easter Vigil. Remember that in some parts of the early church, all baptisms were done at Easter. That was the point. you were being washed, you were having this water, you were going through the Red Sea, all right? So for me, whether or not the Red Sea happened, the Red Sea that matters for me is baptism. That's where the Red Sea is alive and well. And that's the water I think about every day, or here behind this great tree of life is one of the cascades of water, or went today to the Railroad Creek, and yesterday to 10 Mile Island, 10 Mile Waterfall, okay, the water. It's time to go. The Christians around the world are trying to do better with water for baptism. Are you getting rid of your fonts that are this size and getting fonts that are this size? Are you seeing fonts even in Lutheran churches where you step in them and the water is poured over you?
And it's in the center, so you see it?
It's in the center, right? It doesn't have dead flies in it. It has bubbling water in it, all right? This is happening in all Christian. You get Roman Catholic churches with immersion fonts. All right, as the church is saying again, oh, you know, it's one thing in medieval times when in medieval countries, except for Jews, every single person was baptized at about 3 days of age. All right, you could see that they kind of would be blasé about baptism. You know what? It's a post-Christian world, right? We should not be blasé about this anymore. I was just in Japan. It is very difficult for active members of Lutheran churches to be baptized, because it cuts them off from the social expectation of doing the Buddhist funeral rituals. This is a big deal to be baptized in Japan. So I thought, I was shamed, you know, it should be a big deal for us again, all right? And all those water texts, all the water in the Psalter, it's, you know, filled with water, are then for Christians, baptism. So I'm not so worried if the stories happened exactly that way, or a little bit like that, or maybe not like that at all.
Even the resurrection?
Do I think the resurrection occurred? Is that what you're asking?
I'm saying, does it matter to you?
I believe that Christ is raised. Now we can begin to say, what does that mean? And of course, even the New Testament gives very different senses of what that means. That Christ was raised, all right? Where Christ's body is. The ascension is only in Luke, all right? So what, where do we encounter the risen Christ? Where is the body of Christ? Mark has one version. Of course, Mark says, go back to Galilee. I'll be there. What does that mean? Matthew leaves him on a mountain. Luke and Acts, same author, have the story that we've popularized of ascension, which, of course, if you're a serious modern person, it's a very difficult story. Where there's no up there for Jesus to have flown up to. Don't forget your science when you go to church on Sunday. Come on, you know, we got one brain. So what do we make? That's another example. What do we make of that kind of story if there's no up in the world? Where does Jesus go? What's that story about? And of course, John says 7 days later, 7 days later, they encounter Jesus again and again, okay? That the idea is that we meet the risen Christ weekly when we meet, right? Some of the New Testament writers talk more about something like immortality of the soul, and some talk more about resurrection of the body at the end of time. So that's a great topic for next year, all right? What does even the New Testament say? What are different ways of understanding what the resurrection is? What have Christians through the centuries said about it? What are modern Christians saying about it? So, do I believe in the resurrection? Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. Could what I would the Oxford Confession say?
Oh, what's the Oxford Confession?
I think they'd have Jesus alive on Easter. Yeah.
It's time to go. thank you all for caring about these topics. Go back and have fun with all these different things.